There could only be one world leader at a time. For many years it was Rome, then French, then the Spanish, and finally the British for 350 years. And then at the end of World War I, they did not keep their commitment when on March the 7th, Hitler marched into the demilitarized zone where he was not allowed to go. There could only be one leader at a time. And when they looked to the Prime Minister of Great Britain to speak, he did not. We now know that the German troops had on their possession withdrawal commands because their army was so weak that if it met any resistance at all, Hitler would have withdrawn. The army next door in France was 11 times greater than Germany. But because it didn't lead, they occupied the demilitarized zone, got increasingly excited, and moved in 1938 into both Austria and then into Czechoslovakia. And finally, because of the lack of leadership, in September 1st, 1939, they marched into Poland, and 55 million people died in World War II. Because of that, the world looked to America. And on April 1st, 1947, in a letter that was sent from the Prime Minister of Great Britain, I'm trying to think of his name. His name was, it'll come to me. Clement Attlee. Clement Attlee wrote a letter to Harry Truman and said if the United States did not intervene in the Cyprus crisis, that it would be lost. The crown had neither the capacity nor the will to protect them. And with that, the torch was passed to the only nation in the history of man that became the world leader that didn't seek it and didn't ask for its or bear the responsibility or the burden for being there, but only because of the righteousness of its cause became the world leader, and in my opinion, has behaved very, very well until recently. In the summer of 1991, when Ukraine wanted independence, they invited the president at that time to come and encourage them not to do so. He gave a speech on August 1st saying that they should not be occupied by mindless nationalism. They listened to him gently and 23 days later voted 29 million to 2 million for independence from Russia. They then were the third largest nuclear power. They had all these nuclear weapons. They didn't know what to do with them. And they said, would you please take them? America said, no. They said, we'll give them to anybody you want except one place, Russia. They said, that's who we want you to give them to. And so they gave their nuclear weapons to Russia with the assurance at the 1994 Budapest Accord signed by our president that the United States of America would protect its borders, just as we had done in Germany and Japan and elsewhere. But you and I know that a few years ago when the tanks rolled into Crimea and across the Ukrainian border, the United States of America did not act. And they are now being occupied. That is the first time that America has not kept its word. And that's why we were very, very concerned about what would happen and what America's standing in the world would be. And so we invited a European statesman to come and encourage us to recognize the importance of our spot in the world. When we invited him, we were not certain that we would be as cheerful as we are now, and we were fearful about where we would stand, but our speaker is Daniel Hannan, a writer, journalist, and British conservative politician. For 17 years, a member of the European Parliament for representing Southeast England and the Conservative Party, and has campaigned faithfully to withdraw from the European Union and was finally successful in eliminating his job with the Brexit referendum on the 23rd of June, 2016. He writes for a number of publications, including the Daily Mail, the Daily Telegraph, the Wall Street Journal, the Australian. Recognized for the book Inventing Freedom, that you definitely want to read, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. Invited here particularly because of his authorship of Why America Must Not Follow Europe. He is a father of a three-month-old, a father of a teenage daughter, with whom he has an obligation that he promised to keep tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in London. And he came to keep his word to us because I believe, in my opinion, ladies and gentlemen, the finest speaker in the world, member of the European Parliament, Daniel Hannan.
Thank you. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, and thank you to Bob for those very generous words. Ladies and gentlemen, let me begin with a little story that seems apt to our times. God Almighty looks down on the world, and behold, it's corrupt. He decides he's going to have to start again, but he's going to save one good man. And so he dispatches the angel Gabriel, who comes to the prophet Noah, and he says, Noah, the Lord commands that you build an ark, that you hew it of gopher wood and pitch it within and without with pitch. And Noah says, hang on, gopher wood, that would contravene the EU's Sustainable Habitats Directive. I'd need to find some alternative. Undeterred, the angel carries on. It should be of 300 cubits in length and of 50 in width and of 30 in height. Noah says, hang on, cubits. I can't do that. That would contravene the EU's Metrication Directive. I'm only allowed to work in metric units. And Gabriel says, and the Lord commands that you fill it with every animal, clean in their sevens, the unclean, each male and female after its kind. And Noah says, haven't you heard of the Transport of Live Animals Directive? Well, the angel is very puzzled by this, and he returns to his maker and he says, Lord, what is this EU whereof thy children speak? And God says, verily, the EU is the reason I'm sending the flood. Well, I'll tell you what, he's sent the flood now, but at least Britain has built itself an ark. And it gives me such pleasure, my friends, to be able to speak as a representative of an independent country to people in another independent country. You know, you read a lot of things about what were the British people really voting for, what was motivating them, was it a nativist vote, was it a protectionist vote? Do you know, all you have to do is look at your own Declaration of Independence. In the last 8 years, I got tired of asking anyone here to read the Constitution, right? Let's set the bar a little bit less high and start with the Declaration of Independence and look at how aptly those ringing phrases applied to our subordination before the European Union. A jurisdiction alien to our constitution, abolishing our free system of English laws, pretending to a power to legislate for us. We voted to become a self-governing country. Like, you know what? Like you did back in 1776, and from where I'm standing, it worked out okay for you. You voted leave, and now we've done the same thing. I'll tell you what, though, it is hard to stress how unbalanced that campaign was, the sheer asymmetry of it. We were up against every broadcaster, every political party, every business, every NGO, every bank. A lot of commentators, they reach easily for cliches, and they said it was David versus Goliath. You know, I don't think that even begins to do justice to it, right? We're moving from Genesis to Samuel now, right? We know that Goliath was a big guy, 6 cubits and a span, right? The haft of his spear was as a weaver's beam, and he wore an helmet that weighed 600 shekels. He was a pretty big guy, but there was only one Goliath. You want really to get a sense of what happened on the 23rd of June? Imagine that Goliath had said, hey, I don't like the look of that little guy. Imagine that he'd sent back to Gath for reinforcements, that he'd got a mob of 50 or 100 Philistine spearmen and that they'd rushed at young David en masse and boom, 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 one after another, they'd all gone down with sling stones in the middle of their foreheads. Then you're getting a little bit closer to the asymmetry of forces that we faced. One of the things that was in the balance against us was that the Remain side had called in every foreign head of government who owed David Cameron a favor, including your outgoing president. He came and he told us in no uncertain terms that we had to vote to stay in. He said, if you vote to leave, you'll be at the back of the line before there's any trade deal with the US. In fact, he considerately translated it into British vernacular for us. He said, you'll be at the back of the queue for any trade deal with the US. Well, I've got to tell you, it had some impact. There were 4 opinion polls published the following week, and they all showed a large swing to leave. So I'll tell you what, it's... it's not often that I get the chance to say this, but thank you, Barack Obama, because I think you may have been the guy who made the difference and brought my country back to self-government. Now, here's an interesting thing, and this is, I think, something that our two recent electoral upsets have in common. People proved wiser than their experts, right? I saw your results coming in, and I saw that there was a dip in the stock exchange, and everyone was talking about an economic contraction. And I made one response on Twitter. I put a tweet out saying, America is going to boom. Buy the dip. Right? The Republicans are in charge of both houses. There's going to be deregulation. There's going to be tax cuts. And, of course, within 24 hours, the Dow was at its highest level ever, right? Which just goes to prove that you don't really have to be that smart to be better than Paul Krugman. You know, it's... But the reason that I was so confident that things were going to work out well is because I had just seen that playbook, right? We had been through exactly the same thing in our campaign. We were told, if you vote Leave, unemployment will go through the roof. In fact, every single month since the vote, unemployment has fallen. It is now at its lowest ever level. We were told... investment is going to dry up. In fact, there has been record investment. There have been more startups launched since the vote than before it. We were told your stock exchange will collapse if you vote Leave. We told you the shares will go through the floor. We weren't told that that would be Italian shares and that actually the British stock exchange would be the best performing in Europe. The point is, people, when they were placed under all this pressure from all the experts and the economists and the academics and the politicians and all the broadcasters telling them what to do, they went with their common sense. They politely disregarded all the bullying, all the hectoring, all the threats, and they did what they knew to be right. And if you want to understand what happened in Britain on the 23rd of June, or indeed what happened here 2 weeks ago, you could do a lot worse than some words written in 1791 by the patriarch of conservatism, the great Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. Think about the distance between the chattering classes and everybody else and ponder these words. He said, because half a dozen grasshoppers concealed beneath a fern make the field ring with their importunate chink, whilst thousands of great cattle take their repose in the shade of the British oak and chew the cud in silence. Pray do not imagine that those who make all the noise are the only inhabitants of the field. Well, I'll tell you what, my friends, they're still making an awful lot of noise. Those crickets are chirruping like anything, but they didn't have the numbers, and they were shown to be wrong. Their predictions have evaporated, and the sturdy common sense of the American people, like that of my own fellow countrymen, prevailed on the day. And I am now hugely optimistic. It was something that I found really, really touching, which I don't think is very well known on this side of the Atlantic, but it's something that was so beautiful. The day after Barack Obama's back of the queue line, Mike Pence, or rather the state of Indiana, took out advertisements in British newspapers saying, Cousins, you're always at the front of the queue in Indiana. And now I hear Donald Trump saying the same thing. And this is the opportunity we now have, right? Britain voted to leave out of optimism, out of self-belief and self-confidence. Not all the money in the world could sell a bad idea. We could see that the European Union was a failing, top-down, leftover 1950s project, redundant in an age of the internet. We wanted to rejoin the wider world, to become once again a merchant and maritime country, trading with every continent and every archipelago, no longer tied to the world's only shrinking customs union. And up at the top of our list of trade deals will be, I hope, one with our strongest ally and our dear friends on this side of the Atlantic. But now let me make a difficult admission as a free marketeer and as a conservative, we have a lot of ground to make up. Here is the paradox of our age. There's never been a better time to be a human being than now. We are living longer, healthier, happier, and freer lives than at any moment in human history. Extreme poverty, defined as living on a dollar a day or less at 1990 prices, extreme poverty has fallen from 38% of all human beings in 1990 to 8% today. Why? Because previously closed economies, particularly in East Asia and Africa, have joined the global market system. Trade has lifted our species to a pinnacle of wealth previously unimaginable. You can measure this in 100 different ways. More than 90% of girls on the planet now complete at least primary education. A car moving at full speed today emits less pollution than a stationary car in 1970. Right. I could spend the whole of the rest of my allotted time giving you the good news. But here's the paradox. With all of that wonderful data in the background, young, idealistic people, decent, altruistic millennials, are protesting every G7 meeting, occupying Wall Street, sitting in, convinced that trade somehow hurts the poor and favors the big corporates. When, of course, free trade does exactly the opposite. It's the big multinationals that love the distortions and the barriers that are created by a protected trading system. And it's the poorest people on the planet who stand to gain the most when those restrictions are eased. And we need to win that argument. Frankly, both of your presidential candidates were responding to public opinion. You know, I've been a politician long enough to know that that happens. I don't blame them for it. But we need to educate people, to show them the wonder of our age. Here's a different way maybe of putting it. I saw an extraordinary thing on cable TV here last year. An American man decided to make himself a chicken sandwich. Now, nothing very unusual there, you might think. But this chap decided to do the whole thing from scratch. He milked a cow, he curdled the milk to make cheese. He ground grain and baked bread. He went to the sea, collected some water, boiled it off to make the salt. The whole thing took him 6 months. Okay? And by the way, I think even that 6 months was kind of a cheat because he didn't raise the cow himself. He didn't grow the wheat himself. And he used a plane to go to the seaside to collect the brine. If he'd actually had to design and build an aircraft, I think it would have taken a lot longer than 6 months. Now, that's what life is like without trade and specialization. That's how, just think for a moment of where we would be if we were not able to rely on a network of voluntary exchange. 6 months to make a sandwich, right? Not a smartphone, a sandwich. It's the most human thing, the most natural thing to become blasé about what is familiar, right? G.K. Chesterton said, we are perishing for lack of wonder, not for lack of wonders. We don't see the miracles around us every day, but the next time you stop and buy a chicken sandwich, just for a moment, ponder what has gone into it. Not just the chicken and the mayonnaise and the bread, but the guy who drove it, right? And the lady who did the accounts for the haulage company and all the rest of it. And then ponder the miraculous fact that that sandwich was brought to your doorstep at a price that someone could buy for 19 minutes work on the minimum wage. That's the measure of the achievement of the free market. 6 months, 19 minutes. And in that shrinkage of time, from 6 months to 19 minutes, is found the whole of human civilization. Smallpox vaccines, and space travel, and Snapchat, and Starbucks, all of it in that shrinkage of time. You know, we all have left-wing friends who will say, yeah, okay, I accept that the free market may be efficient, but it's soulless, right? We've all heard people say that. We all know people who make this line. You know, yeah, optimization of capital and resources, all a perfectly good idea, but what about the really important things in life, right? A big bank account isn't comparable to playing with your kids, or listening to Beethoven, or having a walk in beautiful countryside. But my friends, it's capitalism that made all of those things possible. It's that shrinkage from the 6 months to the 19 minutes that has made life the way it is. It's because you can now use a dishwasher instead of having to do everything by hand that you're able to go and listen to the Beethoven symphony. Right? It's because you don't have to take six different trams to get to work because you now have a car that you're able to have the time to go for a nice walk in the countryside. It's because we don't have to spend 7 days a week working dawn to dusk just to feed our kids that we have time to play with them. All of that has been made possible by the free market. You find me a more ethical system. You find me a more moral system than one based on completely free voluntary exchange. It was about 10,000 years ago that our species discovered agriculture. Learned that you could put seeds in the ground instead of having to forage. And I'm afraid that it took about 5 minutes before somebody made the next obvious discovery, which is that it's easier to steal somebody else's crop than to spend all year tending to and then harvesting your own. And then it didn't take long before the real breakthrough, which is, hey, we can regularize this plunder. We can actually systematize it through tolls and tithes and taxes, and we can sit at the center living on everybody else's labor. And that was pretty much the story of our species for the last 10,000 years. You know, an Iron Age slave empire would have not been so different from a modern African kleptocracy or a medieval European monarchy. A small group of people would have been looting the system while almost everybody else worked from dawn to dusk in the production of food. And then the miracle, the breakthrough, the idea that you could trade as an autonomous individual selling your services, that there was something above the government and that something was the rule of law, that the individual was greater than the collective. If there is a better idea out there, I have yet to hear about it. Don't dare tell us that you have some monopoly on morality. Every other system devised by human intelligence, you get rich by sucking up to the people in power. Whether they're commissars or high priests or kings, free market capitalism is the only one where you prosper by providing a service to the people around you. It is the most moral system ever created. Now, my friends, we have an opportunity now. For the last 44 years, the United Kingdom has not been able to sign free trade agreements. All of the trade of the 28 member countries of the EU is controlled by Brussels. Brussels can be very protectionist. We now have an opportunity to use leaving the EU to revitalize the entire world trading system, raising living standards for people in the poorest countries on this planet, but doing so not at cost to our own taxpayers, but rather at huge benefit to our own consumers. With the biggest benefits being felt proportionately by the people on lowest incomes, because they spend the highest proportion of their incomes on buying the commodities that are regulated or subject to tariffs or quotas. We can do that. But there is a real challenge to get this right, and this is why I wanted to talk to you as our friends and allies in the United States. See, if I was doing a deal with the people in this room, if I sat down and said, let's get a good, open US-UK trade deal, we could do it in 5 minutes, right? It would be based on mutual product recognition and mutual recognition of qualifications. If you're allowed to practice on Wall Street, you're allowed to practice in the City of London. If you can sell insurance in the UK, you can sell it here. Simple. It would take us 5 minutes. If we leave it to our Foreign Office and your State Department, I think it will look very different. The trade deal will grow and grow, and it will start being about ecological standards and women's rights and child labor and everything except trade. And eventually it'll get to be like the two Obama trade initiatives, TTIP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where effectively what was happening is that big corporates on both sides were getting together and saying, hey, let's take the worst of your regulation and mix it in with the worst of our regulation. And then nobody will ever be able to afford the compliance costs. We will have built barriers to entry that cannot be breached, and we will have established a monopoly that will last forever. Right? The clue here, by the way, is that they're not even called free trade deals. Right? In TTIP and the TPP, the words free trade don't even exist in the title. They're not even pretending anymore. But we can do this differently. We can have an open, consumer-based system that is about extending choice rather than restricting it, and is based on mutual recognition rather than on standardization. And if we get that right, we can do so much to lift living standards across the world. All of the producers, the Ugandan farmer, the Sri Lankan seamstress, the people who haven't been able to sell to a big G7 country will get the opportunity to do it. That is the huge opportunity if only we can get this right. Bob, in introducing me, spoke of, he gave us a potted history, or at least political-military history of the 20th century. Our two countries have stood together more than once to save freedom and to elevate a system of government where the individual is above the collective over one where the reverse is true. Today is the exact 100th anniversary of the end of the Battle of the Somme, the bloodiest battle in the bloodiest war that my country has ever been engaged in. Almost every British family was touched on one level or another by that maelstrom. My own great uncle was 24 years old. He was a gardener, plucked from a world of tending to living things, plunged into the hellishness of the sterile trenches, the muddy sumps. He never made it home. If you ask which were the countries that were on the right side every time there was a conflict between freedom and autocracy, it's a short list. But it includes the United States, it includes the United Kingdom, and it includes the community of free English-speaking nations. Your fathers and ours, on more than one occasion, stood together to make the world better and safer and freer. And that's, compared to what we're doing now, that was the really hard task. All we now need to do is to lead by example without firing a shot in anger and spread prosperity through trade and competition. But let's think of what it is that we're preserving. That system uniquely where the rules were above the rulers. The three terrible conflagrations of the last 100 years, the First and Second World Wars and the Cold War, you and we were on the right side all the way through, standing up for the individual and not for the state. And this is why I am asking for your help. As Americans, I want you to be true to your own nation and to the promise on which it was founded. My country developed and exported the sublime ideal that laws should not be made nor taxes raised except by our own elected representatives. And those ideals were distilled in a little secular miracle in the old courthouse in Philadelphia into the best and noblest constitution ever written. And the promise of that constitution didn't just keep this country great and strong and free. It drove your fathers across the seas to take liberty to every continent and archipelago. That's the real legacy of this nation. A nation that took a dream of freedom and turned it into a functioning state. And then planted the flag of that state on the moon. That attracted tens of millions of people from every corner of the world because they had a dream of liberty, and that then freed hundreds of millions of people from the most tyrannous and murderous system ever devised by mankind. That's your legacy. Let me finish then by making a heartfelt plea, as a British conservative who loves his country, to American conservatives who still believe in theirs. Honor the vision of your founders. Preserve intact the freedoms that you were fortunate enough to inherit from your parents and pass them on securely to your children. Never be afraid to speak to and for the soul of this nation, of which, by good fortune and God's grace, you are privileged to be part. You have a ticket?
Daniel, thank you. And one of the keys of the Council for National Policy is we like to interact. And so while we have this final 10 minutes, if anyone would like to ask a question to the parliamentarian, if you will just raise your hand, you'll see the gentleman with their microphones, and we'll be glad to come to you. Okay? And I will say that with the lights, it's sometimes of a challenge. Do you see one? Yeah. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Bob. Yeah, Mark Skousen. I'd like to add, you really emphasize free trade, but isn't it really true that one area that a lot of us conservatives and libertarians have had a problem with Donald Trump is his anti-trade rhetoric? Does he really understand what free trade is all about?
Well, I mean, these are kind of private meetings, okay? So let me say something to you privately as a politician. I've been nearly 20 years in elected office. With presidents, with elected politicians, it's not so different as it is with small children. If you want to get good results, accentuate their positives rather than just scolding their negatives, right? This is right, isn't it? We both know this, right? People respond to descriptive praise better than they respond to being shouted at, and that's true whether they're 3 years old or whether they're the incumbent in the White House. So Donald Trump, you're right, has said some pretty alarming things about trade vis-a-vis China. If he implemented half of what he's threatening in terms of tariffs with China, I think both China and the United States would be toppled into a recession. And that, by the way, would not just be your problem. It would be everybody's problem, right? This country is the largest investor in the US. You're the largest investor in the UK. The impact of a trade war between the largest and the second largest economies on the planet would be calamitous for us as well. He has, however, made a point of using Britain as a counterexample. When he's attacked for being protectionist vis-a-vis China, he says, oh, no, hang on. I'm not a protectionist. I'm worried about China manipulating its currency and undercutting us and da-da-da. But Britain, they're going to be at the front of the queue. Right. So accentuate the positive. Make a US-UK trade deal work. Make it work early. Make it work visibly. And then you encourage him to carry on doing the same thing. The only way to make trade really popular is to go ahead and do it and let people enjoy the benefits. Right? It's a difficult argument to win in the abstract. But the countries that have opened their markets, Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, they never want to go back. No one in those countries now seriously says, oh, let's go back to an age of tariffs and subsidies and quotas. Because once the benefits start flowing, everybody gains. And the people who gain the most are the poorest people. Some of the people, by the way, who voted for Donald Trump will be the biggest beneficiaries of a more open market. So let's take this advantage. I tell you, my friends, we're in an unfrozen moment here. Right? Britain is leaving the European Union. We've got 2 years to get this right. An opportunity like this is not going to come again. And if we get it right, the benefits will be planetary.
Rich.
Mr. Hammond, thank you so much. It was so inspiring to watch the people of Great Britain vote for Brexit. But now, recently, I've read that there are some that are saying Brexit won't actually happen unless Parliament votes for it. So give us some assurance that Brexit will, in fact, occur, and how will that happen?
Well, it's true. Parliament has to vote for it. We're a parliamentary system. Referendums, in theory, in Britain are only advisory. In practice, MPs are not going to vote following a referendum result against the will of the people. It is almost unthinkable. And both the big parties, the Labour and Conservative parties, have both said that they're going to get on with this process. So yes, there will be a vote in Parliament, but it will be a vote in favour of beginning the process of disengagement. We will leave in 2019. The question isn't whether we're going to leave. In Brussels, they still doubt it because they struggle to imagine any alternative dispensation. But in Britain, that's really not an issue. We're leaving. Nor really is the issue when we're going to leave. We're going to leave in the first half of 2019, probably on the 1st of January. The question is, how do we make this process cordial and mutually advantageous? How do we use Brexit to bring benefits not only to ourselves, but to our allies in Europe and to our allies in the rest of the world? We don't want to leave the EU in a way that hurts it. We don't want to leave the EU in a way that causes, for example, the euro crisis to flare up again, right? We have an interest in the prosperity of our immediate neighbors, if for no other reason than that prosperous neighbors make good customers, right? But we also want to use this process to start unblocking trade from Asia, from Africa, from South America. As one small example, New World wine faces a 32% tariff when it's being sold to the EU, right? So I cannot, I mean, if for no other reason than to enjoy more of your Californian Cabernet, that would have been a pretty good reason to vote, you know, sovereignty would have been a happy bonus. But even if you're not a free trader, who is benefiting, right, from a protectionist policy in viticulture? Right? I mean, where are the great vineyards in Yorkshire that need to be protected from California? Right? So it's an absolutely, this is one of those situations where there are no losers. Everybody can be better off. So it's a question of using the process to maximum advantage to everybody. And by the way, I mean, the wine is a kind of funny example, but the EU policies vis-a-vis Africa are not so funny. The EU will allow you to export raw cocoa with almost no tariffs. If you try and export finished chocolate from Rwanda, Ghana, wherever, you face a 28% tariff. In other words, EU policy is deliberately keeping African countries in poverty and dependency. Now, outside the EU, we can do an awful lot better than that.
Jerry Corsi.
It's Jerry Corsi from WND. Just to be clear, the Trans-Pacific Partnership looks like it's pretty well dead, even in the lame duck session.
Yep.
When you talk about renewed trade between Great Britain and the United States, there's a counterpart transatlantic deal that was also negotiated by the same multinational corporations and the Obama administration. Are you in favor of that counterpart being agreed or a new agreement with these two that were Obama era
right.
big business agreements being defeated?
I mean, the good news is I think they're both dead. There were good, I don't want to overdo this. There were good elements. There were some good elements in both of them. There were some liberalizing elements. But your basic point is correct. The corporates had got their hands on them and were using them so that they were favoring the producer rather than the consumer. And that's what gives free trade a bad name, right? That's why these youngsters are protesting. They think that they're protesting against free trade when what they're really protesting against is the opposite of free trade. It's corporatism. I'm in favor of starting from scratch, doing a very simple deal based on mutual recognition of products, services, and qualifications. And, you know, you won't find two countries where that's an easier deal to do. We have the same language, we have the same legal system, we have the same political culture, we have the same economics culture. We are the largest investor here, you are the largest investor in the UK. The only thing that isn't following is trade, because up until now it's been controlled by Brussels. Well, I think we can do a lot better there.
Daniel, Margaret Thatcher declined to, at Maastricht, to do away with the pound. How would it have been if you tried to extract yourself had you been had the common currency?
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, not only did she get that right, she was ousted because of having called against the euro. I mean, this is the even now I find this an incredible observation. The most successful British Prime Minister was toppled from office because she didn't want to join the euro, right? Who got that one right? You know, frankly, had we joined the euro, it wouldn't be a question of extracting ourselves. The euro crisis would have blown, the currency would have blown apart in a very ugly way in 2009, had an economy of the size of the UK been part of it. Interestingly, the same people who predicted the end of the world if we didn't join the euro were the same ones who predicted an economic collapse if we left the EU. They were wrong then, they've been wrong this time, and I think the same kind of people are wrong in your country.
I know I speak for many of us when we learned this week that a great icon of a British mastery, Winston Churchill's bust, apparently is being shined up and being returned to its place of honor in the White House. And frankly, listening to your speech, certainly reminded me of the tenacity of that man. But my question is this, again to free trade. We have had a remarkable change, really, in the GOP because of this election. Reagan Democrats have returned to the GOP for the first time in a long time. And they're looking for jobs. They're looking for employment. We have a particular generation of Americans in their 40s to 50s that really had lost all hope until Mr. Trump gave them that hope again. Speak to us about labor and jobs and retraining and how America, to maintain itself as a free trader, can also not forget about a whole generation of workers.
I'm hugely optimistic about this country, and I'm hugely optimistic about its economic future. We should, however, acknowledge that any disruptive technology creates losers as well as winners. And a politician who lies about that or pretends that there's a magic wand is not doing a favor to the people he's appealing to. Right? When telephones came in, a lot of people who operated telegraphs were out of work. Right? And when there is a whole community based on a particular industry, we shouldn't minimize the personal cost. My constituency in the southeast of England has very few of these heavy industries, right? It's not the equivalent of the Pennsylvanias and the West Virginias and so on that we've been hearing so much about. The one exception is I had a big shipyard in Kent, Chatham Dockyards. It was the original home of the Royal Navy. It was employing 10,000 people at height, and it closed in 1984. And there was anger ever since because evil Margaret Thatcher had closed it down because she hated working class people and blah, blah, blah. You can imagine the resentment. And in a way, I don't blame the people for feeling angry. If you're 50 years old, you've worked in a shipyard, you don't have readily transferable skills, the closure of that plant is a disaster for you from which you're not easily going to recover. And we should acknowledge that. But nobody ever tells you the happy ending. There are now more people employed per square inch on the territory of the old dockyard in Chatham than at any moment ever in the past. And what are they working in? Well, part of it is Medway University, part of it is the main employer there is audiovisual. If any of you watch Call the Midwife, that's where we make it. If any of you watch Sherlock, it's made in those dockyards. Same thing, by the way, in Belfast. The dockyards close there is where they make Game of Thrones, right? Now, it is possible that the people who lost their jobs will regret that change, but I don't think so. My own grandfather was a shipyard worker on the Clyde in the west of Scotland. I never knew him. He had an unhealthy west of Scotland life. He died when he was very young. I suppose it's conceivable that he would have wanted me and my cousins to follow him in that profession. But I think it's likelier that he'd be happy to see us tapping at a computer screen for a living instead of doing the brutal job that he had to do. So the answer when there is a case of localized loss is not to try and preserve against all the economic forces in the world an old industry which you can't do, nor is it to pretend that you can because you insult people's intelligence. It's to create opportunities where other things can flourish instead. And that's a question of getting the government regulation right, getting the tax incentives right. This country could have a tremendous future with new technology. You have an inventive people. You have a great legal system. This should be the bit of the world where all of the breakthroughs are coming in biotech and driverless cars and additive and subtractive manufacturing. It's just a question of government not getting in the way of a genius of a free people. Let me close, since you began with Winston Churchill's bust, with something that the great man said about the EU. So I think he would be happy about what's just happened. He said, "We are with Europe, but not of it. We're linked, but not combined. We're interested and associated, but not absorbed. And should European statesmen address us in the words which were used of old, 'Shall I speak for thee to the king or the captain of the host?' We should reply with the Shunammite woman, 'Nay, sir, for we dwell among our own people.'"
One more. Daniel, what do you see the other nations of Europe over this next? Will there be more withdrawal, do you think?
Gosh. In the end, it's doomed. How long that process takes is hard to gauge, right? The fact that something doesn't work doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Otherwise, we'd have never had the Soviet Union. A lot of people said, oh, the Soviet Union isn't going to work. Yeah, they were right. It wouldn't have been much fun to have been born in St. Petersburg around about 1910 and lived through the process of it not working. Okay? So there's a deal of ruin in the EU. There's a deal of ruin in a union. The euro has palpably failed now in the sense that it's made its constituent nations poorer. That doesn't mean it's going to be abolished. But ultimately, the idea that you can jam different peoples with different conditions and needs, with different languages, different economies, different cultures and traditions together, and try and make that a functioning state and preserve the basic freedoms and democracy that they used to have as independent states, that is not feasible. Now, the famous sermon that American politicians are so fond of quoting from John Winthrop about the city on the hill, right? He made another sermon after they'd arrived, and there was a line which stuck with me. He said, he was talking about the importance of what names you give your children. He said, a good name is like a thread around your thumb. Reminds you. Kind of tough if your name is Daniel, as mine is. That's an act to follow. But I'll tell you what, I think he had the EU's number, right? You remember the story of Daniel, right? At Belshazzar's feast, he's called in to interpret what do the words mean. And he looks at a big multinational empire. He explicitly looks at it as an unsustainable coalition of different peoples. And he says, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. In the end, you can't make something work against the grain of human nature. The Soviet Union, with all the resources of a police state at its disposal, tried to create a different kind of human being over a period of 80 years. And in the end, humanity reasserted itself. Now, of course, the European Union is not the Soviet Union. It doesn't send us to gulags. It doesn't take our passports away. But the idea that it can work against humanity, that it can impose a rationalist ideal on the organic reality, the evolved reality of human beings, is every bit as unsustainable as the Marxist-Leninist dream was.
On behalf of a grateful council, we say thank you very much.